Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer. SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting.
Than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience.
With Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is James Jackson. This is our usual Saturday Sports Media Roundtable, and we have three of the regulars back. John Lewis, founder and editor of Sports Media Watch. Armand Brody, multimedia player at Sports Media Watch. I'm going to come up with something better, Armand, as we head forward, because you guys will obviously be back, so I need a better title than that. Derek Futterman, of course, the Knicks correspondent for Sports Media Watch.
Oh, gosh.
Right? As well as...
I guess so.
Yes, as well as many other things. You can catch all these guys on Sports Media Watch. They just got a very, very good guest. We will talk about it on this podcast. Linda Cohen was their guest on the Sports Media Watch podcast, which is a great guest, given she's in the news this week. Everybody, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Of course. All right, John, I want to start with you really quick. And this is just something I happen to see you post. We taped this on Friday. You posted this today. So your site did, you graded the NBA media partners after the first season of the new rights deal. So you went through ESPN, ABC, ESPN, NBC, Prime Video. You talked about Inside the NBA. You want to just briefly, I'll give you a little free promotion here. Like what did you guys come up with just in terms of like where you landed in terms of these grades?
Well, I thought this was a good opportunity to really take stock of a very interesting season, probably the most interesting season any league has had on TV in a long time with all the changes. ESPN and ABC and TNT, really, for the A side of it, the main broadcasts. I thought Inside the NBA was a really interesting story this year because didn't really seem to work too well during the regular season. They weren't on enough. Didn't really have the same kind of energy and verve that we've seen from them before. But then it all came together in the finals. They did, you know, their finals presentation elevated the ESPN broadcasts pretty significantly. And even though I'll be honest here, and I will say I think Prime had a better studio throughout the season than TNT's Inside the NBA, I don't think Prime or NBC could have done the finals the way that the TNT guys did, especially that game four. That was one of their best broadcasts that they ever did. So, yeah, that was a big one for them.
Was it the three of you guys who weighed in? Were Armand and Derek part of it?
No, this was just my article, but obviously Armand and Derek, I'm sure, have their own views on it. But, yeah, so that was the ESPN side of it. I did want to just quickly say I liked the moves that they made on the game analyst side. I think Tim Legler was a huge improvement, and that's no disrespect to Doris Burke, but Doris and Richard Jefferson, they kind of didn't have well-defined roles. Legler comes in, we know what Legler's going to do. That leaves room for Jefferson to do what he does, although Jefferson might need to tone down what he does a bit based on what we saw at the draft. And then the other networks, NBC did a great job bringing in the nostalgia, but I want to see a little bit of a change with that Jim Fagan AI. That AI is not working for me, and I have a few other little tweaks that I'd make on the presentation side, too. But they did a good job, and Prime, obviously, their studio is great.
All right, real quick, Derek and Armand. Broadly, John basically is giving really good marks to everybody, including Prime Video, obviously, in his first year. I broadly agree with that, by the way. I thought the presentation, I mean, there's obviously nitpicks all over the place. But I think, by and large, the new media partners were excellent for the NBA. And I think if you're Adam Silver and company, and on top of the, you know, $76 billion that you got, whatever, I think you got to be happy. Like, I actually thought they had a really good year. And NBC in particular, the games felt big to me when I watched them during the year. Armand and Derek, I'll give you like a minute each if you want, just to sort of follow up on John. Go ahead, Armand.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what John said, and the topics are things we've talked about throughout the course of the season. Just a couple of things from me. I don't appreciate Reggie sort of stepping over to Rico's call there in game 7 of the West Finals. the Reggie piece is going to be interesting to watch going forward, because if a Steve Kerr does become available within the next 2 to 3 years, what happens there? It still feels like we're waiting on that Greg Olson, Troy Aikman type analyst in the NBA. We really don't have it. There's no Doug Collins. There's no Steve Kerr. There's no Hubie Brown. There still feels like there's another level we can hit in terms of our analysis. But I definitely agree as well with Tim Legler and his improvement. And if you noticed, Jefferson deferred to him a lot. And I think that speaks to the authority that Legler has. And I think that was a concerted effort by ESPN to make sure that Legler was treated as their 1A and Jefferson as more of a, not a sidekick, I don't want to reduce him to that, but with a clear defined lead analyst in Legler and Jefferson as the third man to complete that booth. That addition, that change made ESPN's booth much better.
All right, Derek, real quick.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely give plaudits to the ESPN for the finals presentation. I thought having a unique intro for all the games of the series was, you know, obviously that's a massive undertaking, but it's something that enhances the presentation. I can echo the sentiment of Inside the NBA after game four specifically. I was on site at the Garden, and you could see that they were really capturing the moment. I watched it back when I arrived home from the arena, and I think they did a good job encapsulating just that environment. It was really shock and euphoria all in one place after OG Anunoby had the tip in off the Jalen Brunson miss. And it kind of felt like the series was, it kind of felt like a clinching game after the Knicks got that one, to be honest. You kind of knew they were going to close it out. As for the other media partners, I think NBA on Prime, I mean, Prime Video has never done the NBA before. Thought it was a very strong first year. Having Ian Eagle as your lead play-by-play certainly gives you a lot of credibility on the air. But Stan Van Gundy is a strong, you know, analyst. Cassidy Hubbard doing the sidelines. And then give credit to NBA and NBC. And you're bringing back a property that hasn't been on the air for more than 2 decades, approximately. And you did a really good job, I think, capturing, you know, the tradition and blending that nostalgia with, you know, innovating, moving forward the broadcast. Tirico's a strong number one play-by-play. I think Reggie and Jamal had good chemistry that built throughout the year. And on the bench, really good innovation by Sam Flood and the production team there. And you have a rising star on that broadcast as well with Robbie Hummel, someone who has plenty of experience on the college side and now getting more on the NBA side. So I thought it was a very strong year for the partners, that the better, you know, more enhanced broadcast presence for the NBA, more games on broadcast television is very important for the reach of the league. I think we saw that reflected throughout the playoffs, especially, and a really strong final. So all in all, I mean, I know, you know, you try to look for, you know, a little balance in your opinion, but it's mostly positive for me with the NBA, and there's, you know, there's always room to grow, but a really good start in this new rights deal.
All right. Thank you for going for that. Let's go to Linda Cohn. We'll start with her at the top. She leaves ESPN after 3 decades, I think 34 years or so, obviously mostly known, or not mostly, but very well known, I should phrase it that way, for her SportsCenter work earlier in her career. And then obviously a very, very big voice for the NHL, you know, along with Barry Melrose, Steve Levy, John Bruchegras, kind of one of the pillars in terms of really trying to keep that sport public in terms of attention, especially when ESPN did not have the game rights. She, Awful Announcing, I think, was the first to report that she is moving on. You know, to sort of briefly set it up, the West Coast Sports Center, and I'm going to go to you, John, first on this. The West Coast Sports Center basically ends with her. They ask her to come back to Bristol. She doesn't want to leave a beautiful setup in Southern California. You can totally understand that. And eventually, like, you know, whatever projects they sort of were thinking about aren't going to work long term. And so, you know, both places depart. It's a, you know, it's an incredible run at one place. And I think, you know, if both parties sort of step back, like they both got a lot out of it. You know, Linda had a great run, obviously made a shitload of money. ESPN got a great talent and someone who's a big advocate for it. And, you know, you now move on. And I know Linda's going to start a YouTube channel and probably do some other stuff. I think the NHL would be smart to use her in some capacity, just given how much she has promoted that sport. But John, let me go to you. I mean, you know, again, there are people who are very, very associated with the height of SportsCenter, right? Like Oberman, Patrick, Rich Eisen, Craig Kilborn, you know, whoever, you know, name your Kenny Main, Neil Everett. I'm going to miss a billion people. I get it. She's on that list. She's part of, like, what, you know, when you think of that group, when SportsCenter was at its highest cultural cachet, Linda Cohn's part of that group. And so very, at least in my opinion, significant figure in ESPN. How do you see all this?
No question. Obviously, at the very higher end of that group, in fact. Look, the fact is Linda Cohn is somewhat of a trailblazing figure in this industry, because I think for a lot of us who were the women we saw doing sports casting, there's really two of them, Linda Cohn and Hannah Storm. There were other people there, obviously, Robin Roberts. I'm a little bit younger, though, by the time.
Susie Colbert put on that, yeah. Right?
Yeah, Susie Colbert. But, you know, For me, coming in, when I did, I'm a little bit younger. Robin was already kind of off the Sports Center, but doing things like vintage NBA.
Yep.
At that time. But, you know, Linda Cohn, every night, you'd wake up in the morning, there'd be, you know, the 1 a.m. Sports Center would rerun all day long. And so you became very familiar with all of these people, you know. And ultimately, I think for people who grew up watching Linda Cohn, they were not necessarily phased to have a woman broadcasting, whereas people who maybe were 10, 20 years older, that might have been a little bit more of an adjustment. So her role in really setting the stage for what we see now, you know, the three of us today, Armand, Derek, and I, we interviewed Brooke Fletcher today, who did the White Sox game the other day as an analyst. You know,
nice.
Linda Cohn is a key figure in creating an industry where that can happen. And yes, there were women before her. There were women doing play-by-play, including for the White Sox, well before her. But she is one of the reasons why it's become so commonplace today.
Armand?
I remember Linda just always being present, but solid, never made it about herself. And she talked a lot in other interviews, including ours, about how she wanted to make sure people understood how much she loved sports. It sounds so simple and it sounds so elementary, but it came through. Linda, I mean, she didn't really do catchphrases, whereas everybody else had seen during that era of SportsCenter, you had to have something. You had to make it about you to some degree. And for Linda, it was just about loving sports. That came through. And growing up, I didn't think as much about the fact that she was a woman. I just thought that she did highlights well. When you go back and watch the clips of the 90s when they're doing their lead-ins, her writing was strong, her presence was there, the laugh, the cackle that she talks about all the time, it just puts you at ease. And that's a rare trait in sports media today, to have that kind of a calming presence about you. And I think for the 34 years she was there, one of the truly all-time great ESPN SportsCenter anchors, one of the best.
Derek, you would have an interesting take on this to me, because you're the youngest person here. And so, like, Linda Cohn probably for you, like, resonates a little bit different. Like, I think John and I are, John's younger than me, but we're closer in age here. And it's, you know, again, like, the SportsCenter, that brand was so big, Derek, like, at a certain point, like, I can't even sort of explain to people, like, who are, you know, around 30 or under 30, like, it just, like, it like, people, it was a destination for people to watch at 11 o'clock. Like, that is an inconceivable thought right now in the YouTube universe, but, like, that's what it was. And so if you had a star turn on that show, like, you were a made woman or man in sports. Like, that just doesn't exist today. No offense to the current SportsCenter anchors, but I think if they were going to go on Truth Serum, they know full well it ain't the same. So for you, Derek, I don't know. What does Linda, do you think of Linda Cohn more as an NHLer versus, like, a SportsCenter pioneer? I'd be curious, because you are the youngest person on this group.
No, I think of her as a SportsCenter pioneer and someone who, you know, is a massive part of the foundation of the show. She made an interesting point, and John actually mentioned this on our podcast. I did not weigh in on this, but I'll weigh in now. I have the similar experience with John of when they add the ticker on the bottom of the screen, and, you know, you try not to look at it because it's a spoiler. I agree. That's the exact thing. And I know it wasn't like they weren't thrilled about it when they added the ticker to SportsCenter. But, like, SportsCenter is the show of record. It's the show that's been there, the flagship program of ESPN since the launch. It's the first show that ever went on the network when it went live. So, you know, I think about it as, again, a show that's really highly regarded. Linda Cohn has anchored the most editions of the show, 3,500. She's got her final editions today as we're recording. And, yeah, someone who should definitely be looked at as a pioneer. I just think now with SportsCenter, You see people graduating from SportsCenter, whereas SportsCenter was the peak for so many of the anchors in the past. Like, think about Shea Cornett, the host of First Take. Where was she before? SportsCenter host. Elle Duncan, now the lead host for Netflix Sports. Where was she before? SportsCenter, WNBA Countdown, and the other shows that she did there. She did Vibe Check for a bit. Like, I think of SportsCenter like it's still important. But the problem is people get their news in so many different places today. So SportsCenter has had to innovate. They have a pretty big social media presence these days, the SportsCenter branded accounts. SportsCenter for You, those AI-generated versions of the show on the ESPN app with the unlimited subscription. So the show is changing, but I think, you know, it's important to keep it around. It's part of the fabric of ESPN, and Linda Cohn is certainly indispensable. You can't mention SportsCenter without mentioning Linda Cohn.
100. They should absolutely keep it around. It's a brand. Like, it actually has some value for them just in terms of that. And the reality is, just look around, even in today, in 2026, Meet the Press still exists. Face the Nation still exists. 60 Minutes still exists. There is value. You know, it's going to change. It's different than it was back when. But yeah, you can use that SportsCenter brand to do stuff. Quite frankly, Sports Illustrated still exists. You know, it's now a ticket office, right? It's now a place where people buy tickets. It's branded on stadiums. Right.
Well, getting in the SportsCenter top 10 is a big deal.
Yeah. Go ahead, John.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. You know, I'm looking for places to stay in Chicago for, you know, WNBA All-Star. This is a Sports Illustrated hotel.
Exactly. So like the point is, if you have something that Americans know, there's always going to be value in it if you're a smart business person on that. All right. Well, we're not going to spend a ton of time on this because I'll have you guys back as we get closer, obviously, to deeper into the knockout rounds. But I wanted to just get your broad stance on sort of one, World Cup viewership, and two, how we think Fox are doing. I don't have it in me to do 40 minutes on Alexi Lalas today. All right. I mean, there's a million other podcasts if you want to go into it. I can't. I cannot do it today. Apologies to whomever. But so I'm of two sort of minds here, John, on this stuff. One, I think the viewership has been great. And, you know, they're getting, I think, ultimately the dream scenario for them. The United States wins its group. So it's going to stay in the United States for they'll play in the U.S. for as long as that team is alive, which guarantees them, obviously, great atmospherics as well as, I think, big viewership. Mexico won its group. So, again, the other major host, which is probably, I mean, Fox has even said it, the number two popular team for Fox is around. And then, obviously, the big teams are still obviously around, the Spains, the Argentinas, and France. So everything has been going great for them. The numbers of non-U.S. games are fantastic. Mike Mulvihill, who's been tweeting up a storm, their strategy and analytics guy all over the place on Twitter, sent out a stat. 84.3 million Americans have watched the World Cup on Fox or FS1 through the first two games of the group stage. I mean, it's a big, big number. Although the wise ass in me loves to point out then that means 250 million people have no interest in the World Cup in the United States. But John, how do you see it? Like, so there's two things. One, viewership, and then two, generally speaking, how is Fox done? And quite frankly, the answer, like, if you in terms of answer question, how is Fox doing, is really just going to probably be based on how you feel about their studio analysts, not even their game presentation. Like, that's sort of where it comes down. So you could take both things if you wish, John.
Well, let's talk viewership, because obviously it's been tremendous. Now, I will note Telemundo had to issue a bunch of ultimately retractions based on Nielsen recalculating data. So that was interesting, because the Telemundo numbers from June 11th through the 15th, so the first 5 days of the tournament, all had to be revised downward by like 25, 26%. That's not a small thing. That changes the calculus a bit, because Telemundo, albeit on a match window basis, had been outdrawing Fox, which does include pre-match coverage. So it was not apples to apples. But after that revision, that is no longer the case. Fox is averaging more, which makes sense. Usually the English language network does. The point you made about Mexico being the number two team, they are the number two team in this country. You get United States or Mexico, you're golden. What's fascinating to me, of course, if the U.S. loses, it'll be kind of quite the spectacle to see Fox Corporation rooting for the Mexico team.
Oh, John, we've both covered it. They've done this before. This is not new for them.
Yeah.
Well, when the U.S. was out, I mean, you know, you got Eric Shanks walking around with an El Tree jersey, basically. I mean, they're not dumb. They know who their number two team is in terms of viewership.
Yeah. So if you can get the U.S. or Mexico, that, I mean, obviously the U.S. is going to be the historic all-time draw.
Yes.
Historic numbers. But if you can't get them, and I think a lot of people don't necessarily expect them to go the furthest, if you can somehow get Mexico in there, maybe not even in a final, but in a semifinal,
amazing.
You can still be looking at some pretty incredible numbers there. So obviously, it's going to do well all the way through to the end. And really, at this point, sky's the limit.
Jarek, I'll go to you. Any broad thought? You can go viewership. You can go presentation. Wherever you want to go.
I mean, the viewership's been very impressive, especially you look at the U.S. matches. I mean, we had U.S. versus Turkey last night, so we don't have the exact viewership there. But U.S. versus Australia, 16.2 million with a household rating of 6.0, I'm pretty sure. So yeah. Very strong numbers there from the start. I believe the game previous to that was I think, like 18 million. I mean, these are big numbers for the United States. And obviously, the dream scenario is you get the U.S. in the final. You look at the Fox studio, and I think, you know, people are getting used to it now that we're 2 weeks into the tournament. Obviously, everyone's talking about the dynamic between Alexei Lalas and Zlatan Ibrahimovic. I mean, it keeps people talking. It keeps people interested. I know there's some, you know, broader discussions there about, you know, who do you want in the studio? Do you want people just, you know, giving opinions for clicks? Do you want people kind of always going? Do you want people dissuading from the majority all the time? So it can be a little bit. You know, there's room for fodder and conversation, but I think it's been strong. Rebecca Lowe anchoring the show down. We were talking, it was either this podcast or our own podcast the last time we touched on this topic. And I think, Armand, you mentioned the question of, you know, God forbid something happened and Fox needed to switch over to hard news coverage on their sports feed.
It was Armand.
Who would take it? And he said Rebecca Lowe. I mean, Rebecca Lowe is a very talented, experienced host, and I think she has been the major acquisition for Fox with this tournament, and you've been able to see that impact anchoring the panel in the studio. And, of course, you know, you have the expertise of Thierry Henry, who's really stood out as a studio analyst. So overall, I think Fox has done a good job, but this is a six-week tournament. Let's see how they do through the remaining rounds.
I agree. Rebecca Lowe and Thierry Henry have been far and away two of the best rentals Fox Sports has ever had on its airwaves. I also think, and they did this the last World Cup too, great job bringing Ian Dark in, who gives them yet another excellent game caller. I happen to think their game calling group is good. You know, Derek Ray and Ian Dark. I think John Strong is fine. So the conversation about Fox when it comes to presentation is almost never about the game presentation anymore. It's essentially the studio and, quite frankly, how you feel about Alexei Lalas getting a prime time real estate. That's essentially the debate. Anyway, Armand, I'll go to you. Me and you both are we're charter members of the Rebecca Lowe fan club. So I welcome you to that as well. But you know, John and Derek really hit on it, man. Like, the numbers are great and the numbers only go up from here. You know, we head to the knockout round. They're only going to be larger.
I think there's something compelling about Zlatan. There are obvious reasons, but I kind of like watching someone who's not super polished in television be themselves. And there have been moments when Zlatan has been just really charming. Like, there was the great shot of the great post that Fox Sports had online of his reaction to the Bosnia and Herzegovina win. And you could just see some raw emotion there. Like, those are the kinds of things that Fox can do. They did it with Pete Rose, right? Where you bring in somebody who don't really think about being a television personality. Now, granted, there were some awkward moments with Pete on that set, but it got attention. It was different. It was interesting. It was a train wreck at times, but it made you want to watch. And so as we go forward, I'm kind of curious to see how Zlatan continues to emerge here, because obviously they swung for the fences, to use an analogy from a different sport. And you're just kind of wanting to see, do you keep the authenticity or do you become so polished in television that you start to lose some of that? And I hope that while the dynamic between he and Alexei Lalas has been awkward, I do hope that Zlatan sort of keeps a little bit of that charm that sometimes being in TV a long time can take away from you a little bit.
It's well said. I'm with you. I like when television doesn't come off like television and it could be like organic or awkward or whatever. By the way, this is one of the reasons YouTube has become what YouTube is. It's because it was people who weren't television per se. Now some of this stuff is overproduced, you know, and their quality of it is incredible. You know, Mr. Beast, I'm sure, has a billion people working on it. But that was kind of the genius of YouTube, is just you just get people just point and shoot and do crazy and interesting shit that didn't look like, you know, HBO prestige kind of television levels. I don't think I prepped you guys on this, but I do want to ask you this. We'll do this really quick because it's really been in the news. Caitlin Clark, we're one of the things that the WNBA, I think, is managing here, and not always well, is that with new eyeballs and fans, you're going to get a ton of people who are going to have opinions on things in your league, and probably at times opinions that you don't like as a league, or quite frankly are not well thought out, or quite frankly are bad faith. Caitlin Clark sort of is the avatar, I think, in many ways for everybody, for many different things, you know, how you see basketball, how you see politics, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, earlier this week, really just brutally bad foul by Alyssa Thomas, who was suspended and rightfully should have been. And it looks like Caitlin Clark now is going to be out for a little bit. But John Lewis, I want to go to you on this. You know, you would know this better than others. And has the Caitlin viewership phenomenon dropped a little bit? And if it has, like, what are your thoughts on this? Because, like, I can understand some saying that, you know, you want to take the one hand, like, you know, hey, it's been too physical with her. The refs do not protect her. You're ruining the golden goose. And then there's a whole other line of people who are like, she's not as appealing as she used to be, complains about fouls all the time, hasn't sort of elevated her game, or just has to come to the realization that, you know, she can't dominate the way she did in college. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting sort of debates on all this, but I haven't really checked the viewership numbers, and I'm kind of curious, like, is there anything here with any of this stuff?
Viewership is an interesting story this year because this is a new media rights deal. And so there's a lot of new partners for the WNBA, and that means different kinds of viewership than we've seen in the past. I don't think Caitlin's played a single ESPN game. She's played a bunch of USA Network games, though. I know that the game against the Tempo maybe a week ago was 1 million viewers. That's not great for a Caitlin Clark game, but it's really great for USA Network. They don't get that kind of audience.
Great point.
Monday against Phoenix. So they played Phoenix twice. The game you talked about with the foul was on Wednesday. Both of those were on USA Network. The Monday game was just shy of 1 million, 940-something thousand. And I'm waiting. We're taping, the 26th Friday. I'm waiting to see if the Wednesday number comes out. And I might have an article about the numbers because Caitlin's drawing okay. They had earlier this season, the game against New York in prime time did a great number on CBS. But it's also the case that not every Caitlin game is getting to that level. So the previous week, you had Caitlin against the Portland Fire in prime time on CBS, but opposite Game 7 of the Western Conference Finals in the NBA. That one didn't do well. Like last week, you had Caitlin and the Fever against Angel Reese and the Dream. And none of those three games between them did all that well this year. The ABC game had 1.7 million, which is still good. Third largest audience of the season. But, you know, obviously they were getting over 2 million for those games a couple of years ago. And then the two that they played, Caitlin and Angel, on Prime Video were the two most watched on Prime Video this year. But six figures, haven't gotten to seven. So a lot of it is kind of hit or miss. Caitlin is still getting to that peak level that she used to, but not for every game, because a lot of those games are now on new platforms that don't draw quite as well.
Interesting. Armand, I'm going to go to you, and I want to say one quick thing. You're welcome. Like, I think everybody obviously has a right to opine on Caitlin Clark, and she's a very, very famous athlete in the United States, and you're going to get some attention if you talk about her. I will say, and this is, I'm just only coming from me as somebody who's covered women's basketball for a long time and currently covers the Toronto Tempo for CBC Sports, and occasionally if there's a business element to it, I'll do it for SBJ. I don't know what the word is, Armand, if it's like hypocrisy or irony or something, but I always take note when it's either an individual or an outlet where the only time they talk about the WNBA is controversy or Caitlin Clark controversy, and never do anything about the league, whether it's X's and O's or another player. And like, to me, like, I have no interest in your take. I'm just talking for me personally. Like, you earn my trust as a viewer or reader if you've actually talked about something away from Caitlin Clark, even if it's like the most generic, like, hey, let me do something on Breanna Stewart and Asia Wilson. Are they the two best players in the league? You know, something really stock. Again, I'm not saying you don't have a right to do this. You do. But that's usually my very sort of like small line, meaning like, are the only time you talking about this shit, like when it's controversial, or will you give me anything else about the league, even in small doses? And I always try to take note of that. That's just sort of how I see it. How do you see all this stuff?
Yeah. Meanwhile, Asia's averaging 26-9 this exactly. year. And I mean, it's already a Hall of Famer, but yeah. So I agree with you. And honestly, I'm exhausted because Caitlin is not allowed to be herself. A lot of people in sports media are only using Caitlin as a symbol for one side of this culture war or the other. And it's sickening. It's annoying. It's exhausting. And I'm sure if I would imagine if Caitlin has, when Caitlin has moments to herself, honest moments, she's got to be wondering, what did I, all I wanted to do was play basketball. All I wanted to do was succeed. All I wanted to do was play the sport that I love at a high level here. Now, does she whine? Yes. Could we say she should be better? Sure. If you want to go that way, yes. But to only care about the WNBA when you want to latch your already existing cultural position to the latest controversy and then try and make it 100 times bigger than it is and force Caitlin Clark in the middle of your garbage, of your foolishness, it's exhausting. It's exhausting, man. We have talked with Paul Irvin, who's an ESPN producer. He produces the WNBA. And we've had the conversations about the difference when she's on the court. And we understand that. That's to be expected. But all this other stuff, as somebody once told me, I multiply it by 15 and I divide it by 16 and I pay it no attention.
That's hard for me to segue from. That was very, very, very well done. I will say very quickly that we're taping this on Friday. Yesterday, Marina Mayberry of, you know, my hometown Toronto Tempo scored 53 points, tying the single season game record Asia Wilson and Liz Cambage. So that's a huge moment for an expansion team. 53 points in their first year, they'll be able to market the shit out of it, beat a Sparks team without Kelsey Plum. That really does, quite frankly, does not play much defense. I'll give it back to you in a second, Armand. So that's one cool thing. And the other thing, just to mention, because it references a podcast, my last podcast before you guys were on, Stan Van Gundy was on this podcast early in the week. He begged his Amazon executives to do a WNBA game this year. He ends up doing that game with Lisa Byington, where there's a single season mark that's set. So Stan Van Gundy has got to be through the roof. Like, he got to see history in the first WNBA game he ever called. Go ahead, Armand.
This is the final thing I'll say on this. I don't need Caitlin Clark to be the great white hope. I also don't need her to be everything that's wrong with white America. I don't need either one of those things. When I watch her, I want to see her through the perspective and the lens of her performance on the court. Because as we talked about on either this podcast or our own with Victor Wembanyama, we don't know these people. We don't know. I don't know Caitlin Clark. I don't know what she's really like. I don't know what she believes. I don't know how she does. I don't know how she functions when she's at her house. I don't know what music she listens to. I don't know. We don't know these people outside of what we see them do on the playing surface. And that's the way I look at Caitlin. And I don't need her to be anything else to save me or to make me feel better about myself.
All right, I'm gonna fit. By the way, I think I do know Caitlin Clark's favorite musician. I'm fairly certain is Taylor Swift. What were you gonna say, John?
Well, I was gonna say, you know, Armand makes some great points because, you know, Caitlin has become an avatar for people wanting to argue about
yes.
different things. This is a 24. This is a 24-year-old, right?
Yeah.
So literally, they like to say now that your brain doesn't develop till you get to 25, not fully. So this is a young person. Who is a person, she is being positioned as
100%.
Yep. Emblem of one, she has a lot of people who are supporting her without really caring about her. When you see these people on social media, they're using the hard fouls against her to make arguments that Caitlyn probably wouldn't agree with.
Agreed.
And beyond that, then she's getting it on the other side, because I have to kind of suspect at this point that some of the physical play isn't just a coincidence. It feels like she's a magnet for it. Look, I've been watching the WNBA for a long, long time. I remember Charlotte 48, New York 44 to get to the WNBA.
That's final. Correct.
And, you know, to me, I've never seen a player kind of be a magnet for this kind of physicality. Right.
And this is not a basketball podcast per se, which gets to why the officials in the WNBA deserve all of the criticism they are getting, because you have a player where you are not, in my opinion, policing, John, what you said. Like, I think that's a massive issue. And I do agree. Like, I do think, you know, I don't want to sort of speculate if it's like envy of fame or envy of money, but I do think, at least it feels like this year, the physicality on her feels, it's a physical league, but the physicality on her does at times feel different. And then that's what you got to call it. If you call it, by the way, it's over. The officials can control this shit, at least for me.
So you call
Derek, if you don't mind. Just,
yeah, go ahead, John, then I'll come in.
You know, to me, Caitlin seems to be taking the heat for the nasty things that people who purport to support Caitlin are saying, that Caitlin herself has never said, never supported, never given any oxygen to. Caitlin is not responsible, in my view. I know people disagree. She is not responsible for the ugliness of people who pretend to be her fans on social media.
I agree. I think that's a terror. Like, she gets tagged, like people get mad that she hasn't called shit out. That's not her job, nor is it her job to like or support anything. Her job is to play basketball, which is why, again, if she decides to go on stage with whatever freaking artist she can, whether it's Taylor Swift or Morgan Wallen, she's got every fucking right to do whatever she wants. I'm totally with you on that. Derek, go ahead. I didn't mean for this to go as long as it did. I'll give you the last say.
It's fine. I mean, I'm just going to draw a comparison to the NBA finals. We saw Victor Wembanyama commit a hard foul on Jalen Brunson. It didn't get called. There was vitriol on social media.
Should have been.
The officiating. Yeah, I mean, the fact is that, you know, people felt that they missed a flagrant. What happened to Caitlin Clark the other day, you know, there was the talk about that. What I've been seeing on social media is that people are taking screenshots of their WNBA League Pass subscription cancellation notices and saying, I've had enough of this. So it's really, I guess, on the league to, you know, really evaluate what's going on and make sure that you're keeping your fans, because the fact of the matter is that your games are more fragmented than ever. You just had a protracted labor disagreement. You came to a deal to salvage the season, not lose games. But the fact is that, you know, the WNBA has really experienced some rapid growth since Caitlin Clark has come into the league. She's been a key driver of it. And, you know, the league has to really appeal to the fans at this point. So we'll see what happens, but it's not a good look.
Derek, I cannot keep up with all the things I'm supposed to boycott. Like, am I still boycotting hip hop or Tipper Gore? Or can I 40 years later, am I allowed to listen to that now? I mean, between Bud Light, you know, WNBA League Pass, hip hop. What else?
Don't forget God, the Devil, and Bob. Remember that?
I don't remember that, John. You're even throwing me three off that. Anyway,
NBC year 2000.
Oh, wow. All right. That's a good upskill. That I can guarantee that is the only time that reference has ever appeared on this podcast. So well done on that. All right. We'll finish up with the New York Times, a story on Diana Rossini. Again, I could do an entire podcast probably just on that story alone, but I did want to sort of get your broad takes. I think I'll wait until you guys are done to give my, not only obviously was it, not only did it sort of focus on someone who is obviously a significant figure in the sports media, but we also got a part of that story, which really gets into sort of a journalistic question where the reporters use an exchange with Diana Rossini, where Rossini responded to a reporter via text. And then after whatever exchange happened, said, this is off the record. the reporters then used that part of the text exchange on the record, and then, which was really sort of fascinating in terms of literally publishing this, sort of publishing that, hey, the standards of the New York Times say that we can publish this. Real, and then I have seen obviously a lot of the journalistic places like Pointer and stuff weigh in. So who wants to go first on this? You can raise your hand here and I'll choose you. Don't all raise your hand at once. All right, John, I'll go to you then first. Go ahead.
Well, I thought it was interesting because I didn't feel like all of it needed to be published. So she says in this text, former journalist. To me, that's kind of like she's feeling sorry for herself and kind of moping a bit, which, you know, I mean, I'm not going to judge anybody for that. To me, would I say, oh, she is saying she's no longer a journalist? Or would I say she kind of feels bad for herself right now and is describing herself as a former journalist almost in an effort to say, you know, woe is me? Would I include that? I probably wouldn't have included that part. I don't necessarily think it sheds much light because to me, I kind of see the context as not necessarily newsworthy so much as maybe a statement of state of mind that isn't necessarily germane to the story. But that's kind of my perspective.
All right. I should probably, for listeners, just give a little better sense of what we were talking about. I didn't really explain that in full well. So there's a section in this piece where, and I'm going to quote from the piece, in early May, after the Times began reporting this article, Ms. Rossini responded to a reporter's request for an interview via text message. She cited the intense scrutiny and personal attacks she had faced, saying, "This has had a significant impact on my life, both professionally and personally." At the end of the message, referring to herself as a former journalist, Ms. Rossini asked a reporter not to quote from the text. The interaction demonstrates a different approach to journalism from the way that is conducted in traditional newsrooms. A bit of a shot on The Athletic, perhaps, there. When the reporter told her that this article would include portions of her text message because no agreement had been made for them to engage in an off-the-record correspondence, Ms. Rossini objected and then emailed Mr. Perpich, David Perpich, the publisher of The Athletic, as well as two senior editors at The Times, to reiterate her wish that her comments not be included. You know, that was a pretty, I'll go to you, Armand, next. That's pretty fascinating that the Times basically let you in behind the curtain on this. My perspective on this is that they intentionally did so, and they are trying to, I think, let the reader at least illuminate, I should say it this way, illuminate for the reader that Diana Rossini in some ways is trying to control the story, right? Or at least using leverage or previous leverage to try to impact it. Very interesting decision by those reporters in the New York Times. And by the way, I think there's an argument to be made that they either should have done that and they were in their rights, or quite frankly, should not have done that and were a little unfair to the subject. But that's just my take, Armand. You can go on the Rossini thing however you want.
No, I'm with you. It came off as though the story was more about the dynamic between the New York Times and The Athletic in some spaces.
Very fair play.
Rather than Rossini. To me, there's not a lot of genuine news here until we get the results of the investigation, which apparently is ongoing. So we run the risk of majoring on the minors to some degree if we are talking about issues that don't get us further along to some kind of conclusion or some sort of resolution. Now, obviously, if you haven't established that something is on the record, if you haven't established that something is off the record, I should say, then don't be surprised when it's on the record. So if that took place and that's what's in the article, then yeah, Rossini, you would think, would know better, given how long she had been in the industry. But for me, I want to know, I want answers to questions that New York Times piece did not give me. So I'm still sort of waiting. And I think there's a part of me, too, I'm trying to disconnect myself from the need to go running at every salacious, potentially salacious detail. detail of the story because I don't want to become that kind of person. I want to be able to respect the actual news value that exists and not just run to the TMZ-like headlines that might generate some attention, but that don't actually provide a lot of substance.
I think, Derek, by the way, that's really well said, Armand. That's a good take. Derek, one thing that got a lot of social media attention, not surprisingly, was the Times reporting, based on their reports of Diana Rossini's salary. I would say that reporting, I mean, I'm always sort of trying to be a little circumspect because obviously I worked at The Athletic for years and know things and I'm privy to stuff where people would have told me as colleagues that, you know, I sort of want to respect that. Whatever salary number that they printed, always keep in mind that the salary would have been different had she then re-signed with The Athletic, and that was sort of ongoing. So you can sort of, whatever numbers you see published, consider those numbers would have been bigger eventually had this not happened. Secondly, I believe Ryan Glasspiegel, front office sports, pointed this out, and good for him on this. Ben Strauss had reported salary numbers prior to this, so you really shouldn't have been that surprised if like that sort of number blew you away. And then lastly, Diana Rossini was represented by CAA. There are also other people at The Athletic who are represented by CAA. Not a ton. Usually it's people who have some kind of television component. And if you are coming from a place where you are part of like the world of television, all three of us know this, you're coming in with a much higher salary base because of where you previously worked. So no one would blink at $800,000 if you're a prominent insider at ESPN with a lot of airtime. I mean, Adam Schefter makes a shitload more than that, right? So while it might be a little surprising if you're a Metro reporter, I get it, in Grand Forks, working for the Grand Forks Herald, making $60,000, and you see somebody making $800 or whatever, like, yeah, I get it. Like, it's crazy, but it shouldn't be that crazy to you. Now, whether anybody working for The Athletic should be paid $800,000 a year as front-facing talent, you got to make that decision. I always support people making as much as they can. So that's a your decision. Although I will say this, Derek, after reading some of the stuff I've read, I think clearly I was underpaid over the last 8 years. Anyway, Derek, let me go to you. Do you have any like larger thoughts on this?
Yeah, I echo a lot of those points. I mean, I will tell you that off the record situation that you guys were touching on with the story was fascinating to get a look at, you know, how it was handled behind the scenes. I know the salary got a lot of headlines to what was reported then in that article, but what stood out to me was the lead. It was a compelling lead. It Great grabbed point. The reader's attention.
You want to tell people who haven't read it the lead? Just you can give a quick summary.
Yeah, I'll give you a summation of it real quickly. But Diana Rossini, I believe, was with her kids in the car and pulled over for texting and driving, and in an attempt not to get a ticket, offered to FaceTime the head coach of the police officer's favorite team, of which was not identified. And the head coach was reportedly said that, you know, oh, she's a good citizen. Don't fine her. Don't give her a ticket or whatever. And I believe she got off free. The fact is that is a major violation of journalism ethics. Danielle Rota, who is the lead spokesperson for The New York Times, echoed as such in the article. I believe she was quoted as such saying that. Take away the Vrabel thing. That on its surface is another problem. When you're using your sources for personal gain, personal betterment, that's what that is. It's a major violation of journalism ethics. And in an era where it seems that ethics in journalism at times are being shoved aside and not really being regarded as anything important or anything that should be followed, like, I think that's a lesson to people that just be responsible. Be responsible with what you do. I certainly will not do that, even though I've talked to people who, sure, like if I decided to be totally unethical, first, I wouldn't be able to live with myself. I have a conscience. Like, I'm not going to abuse access in that way, because that's how you lose access in the end. I mean, it's a privilege, and you have to recognize that being a journalist, you stick to your job. You stay morally in bounds. You stick to ethics and, you know, best practices. And that's the best way to succeed. Don't use your own access. Don't use that advantage for personal gain. I thought that was quite distasteful reading that.
I appreciate you pointing that out. Like, do you think if I'm in Canada and I get pulled over and I say I have Austin Karp's cell phone, is it possible I could get out of a traffic infraction with that? John, do you think?
I don't know. You know, that's a fair question. You know, maybe
I did see that. I did see. I didn't mean to interrupt you because I did see that anecdote, and I appreciate Derek bringing that up. Like, obviously, I think all of us have, you know, well-known sports media people, cell phones, and obviously I've been writing this for 20 years. Like, I was thinking, like, one, I would obviously like Derek. I couldn't even conceive of doing that. But, like, I found it just even, like, doing the thought exercise rather amusing. Like, if I was pulled over and I said, oh, would you like to talk to Joe Buck? Like, let me FaceTime him. Like, it just, it's so preposterous, but it does. I do think, listen, I think the writers of that piece specifically use that anecdote once again, don't you think, to let readers know about access, right? And privilege and sports fame or sports media fame. Like, they made a specific choice to use that anecdote as to sort of set the reader up in terms of what you are to think.
Wouldn't you agree? I'll just say this though, John, before you go, like, wouldn't you agree that that on its own, again, take the Vrabel stuff away, that on its own is a fireable offense in my opinion.
Boy, that's a, you know what? Like, obviously having worked at the New York Times, I would have to have looked at my contract or old contract.
At least a suspension.
Yes, 100% a suspension if that was ever found out. I don't disagree with you at all. These contracts, Derek, are, you know, also unions get involved too. Like, I'd have to look to see some of the provisions to know whether that is fireable. That, you know what I'm saying? Fireable gets into a certain sort of legal point, but I totally agree with you. I mean, that is a fundamental violation of a journalistic tenet to use that kind of access. I mean, it's like it's the worst of what we see in Washington. It's the same idea, right? It's like, you know, my father's the president. Like, I want to sort of cut a deal or something like that. So yeah, I'm you know, fundamentally, Derek, obviously you're correct. The question, is it fireable? I don't know. I would also say probably that star, you know, reporters at any place, whether it's The Athletic or ESPN, probably get a little bit of leeway on the first screw up of anything. So I just don't know the answer to that. It's a great question. Go ahead, John.
Well, to me, whether or not it's fireable, it's, to me, maybe others will disagree, far more unscrupulous, right?
Than what?
Than even what she was alleged, we don't know yet, alleged to have been doing.
Oh, I'm not sure. I don't agree with that, but go ahead. It's your point.
I guess here's my perspective. You could make an argument, and I'm not making this argument, I'm just saying it could be made. You could make an argument, oh, this is true love. They just couldn't be away from each other. It's like Daphne and Niles, right? You could come up with that. But there's no way you could make that argument for using your connections to get out of a traffic ticket. Like, it's not as serious. There's no kids involved. There's no families being ruined. But when you talk about purely unscrupulous behavior done only to get an advantage, at least with the other scenario, you could create an alternate reality where they just were hopelessly in love. In this scenario, this is, I have this ability to call up coaches in the NFL and get myself out of legal trouble that is not trivial. Texting while driving is not trivial, right? And that, to me, I know if we can get to the moral aspect of it, but frankly, even on the moral aspect, we're talking about getting out of a ticket for texting and driving with your kids in the car. If there's any truth to that report, that's pretty morally not great as well. That's my perspective.
Okay, you and Derek have a sort of similar take on this, and I appreciate you sort of you bringing that up based on the lead anecdote. I would have thought you guys would have focused on other stuff, but that gives me some to think about. Here's the last thing I'll say. I'll just give my personal take. If you guys want to weigh in, and we'll end it on this. I think something that that got attention certainly in journalistic circles was the fact that neither the Times nor the Athletic commented publicly. And I've always been one who's believed that you really cannot cover your place accurately. I just don't think you can do it. I think there's too many conflicts there. I know the New York Times does. I know the Washington Post does. I know that PBS has. And I think David Folkenflik there is an excellent media reporter. I just think there's too many conflicts for you to do. And I, you know, the times that I had to sort of do this, and that, there were not many, and I intentionally tried not to do because I believe in this, whether it would be at SI and the Athletic, I think there's just an inherent conflict. And I think you don't do the readers the service. And I think others should cover you and cover you hard. So that's sort of like a larger philosophy. And the Athletic, both the Athletic and the New York Times on this one, I'll paraphrase it, but basically like the Athletic and the Times Company did not make their executives available to these reporters. And one thing that we didn't learn as readers is the why. Now, had you said they didn't make them available because there are still legal proceedings or because there's still an investigation going, I think that if you might not like that, but at least that gives you as the reader like, okay, here's the reason they didn't comment. And I thought that like that would have been so much more valuable for readers than just we're not making them available. Or even if the Athletic or the New York Times just came out with a very bland statement saying, hey, this isn't just acceptable conduct from a reporter, doesn't reflect what we do, it's against our normal practices for the newsroom, I think that could have been valuable. And the reason I just all bring this up is because, like, you know, both the Athletic and the New York Times, obviously myself and you guys at Sports Media Watch, we do ask a lot of the people that we write about to answer our questions, right? And when we request something of them to sort of talk. And so it puts the Times and the Athletic in a very, I think, not a great public spot when they're declining on this, which is a very public and of interest story, when they are almost on a daily bit, not almost, when they on a daily basis are asking people all over the world for comment. And that's why if I worked in their PR department, I would have just had something attached to the decline so that readers knew why it was a decline. It's a sort of a small thing, but I think would have been valuable. Do you guys have any thoughts on that? And then we'll get out of
here. Look, there are plenty of other places to get NFL news and content that, you know, you won't have to question things because nothing's come out suggesting that, you know, conflicts of interest could exist or unethical conduct. I think it's about valuing the reader. We talked about valuing the audience before, valuing the reader's time and attention. There's so many other options. The fact is that I think, naturally speaking, you know, I know there's an ongoing investigation, but you can't help but lose a little bit of trust in the veritability and just the authenticity of the reporting that we've been seeing from Diana Rossini on the NFL beat. And she was the senior NFL insider, the lead person on that beat. You can't help but question it going forward.
Anybody else want to add anything? John, Armand, you got anything? John, go ahead. I'll give you Armand the last one.
I guess I just, you know, kind of to the point I was making before, you know, a lot of this is about personal ethics, right? People do make mistakes. So mistakes, I mean, even serious mistakes happen. It doesn't necessarily mean that we know a person's character from those mistakes. But just from that story and some of the other things, there's a kind of a pattern of behavior that indicates that maybe Diana Rossini did not see her role as one of a journalist, but of someone with access. And using that access in various ways to achieve personal goals or, you know, or to even just brag, right? I mean, remember what we talked about the other day with Tiger and the way that you saw something true about Tiger's character, not from the mistakes he's made, but from him coming out and saying, I was just on the phone with the president. And again, that's not a Trump dig. That could be any president. That could have been Obama. If he had said, I was just on the phone with Obama, it would have been the same.
Agreed.
It tells you something about Tiger's character that he thought that could work. And so that kind of gets back to, you get pulled over for texting while driving, again, assuming that that's true. I haven't done the reporting. I'm just assuming it's true from the New York Times. If your instinct is, let me go call an NFL coach, one, it indicates that you're the type of person who tries to get out of circumstances where you might be more, you know, desirable to just take responsibility. And two, it shows that you have a certain view of the access that you have as a journalist and a certain view of what that can be used for that's probably incompatible with being a trusted reporter.
You got anything, Armand, you want to add?
Yeah, I'm just curious. When does the investigation wrap up? What do we find out from that? And when does Diana Rossini speak on the record about any of this? When that happens, it'll give me a little bit more, because until then, it's almost like everybody sort of saying, I'm not saying, but I'm just saying. And it kind of gives that sense of, we're not getting declarations, we're not getting resolutions, we're getting a little nugget here and a little nugget there. Oh, she's her characters, it should be questioned over here because she did this and she did that, till we get some actual some resolutions here, some conclusions, and some folks actually speaking on the record about a lot of this, and it not sort of coming across more as, you know, hearsay, even though obviously that's not what it was in this case. But it just kind of has that feeling to it, especially considering the way it's lived on social media so much. Until we get something a little bit more firm, it's a little bit difficult for me to fully invest in a lot of the stuff that I've been hearing.
Appreciate that. The one thing, because I did see this a couple places in social media, or maybe it was like one person who was retweeting a Bay account or something like that. Listen, no doubt Diana Rossini did important and very good work at The Athletic, and obviously was a very, very big name. But she definitely, I can say this for sure, was not the person who brought in the most subscriptions for The Athletic. By the way, The Athletic, we used to, when we were there for many years, we would know how many subscriptions we brought in for every single piece of content that that we put out, including when we were hired, sort of our first piece of content, like, you know, why I joined The Athletic piece. You really like sort of knew exactly how many real new subscriptions, and at least in my case, 2018, you got back then. But you have to keep in mind, like, you know, there are people at The Athletic like Dane Brugler who puts out like the big draft beast. Like, you'd be, how do I sort of say this? Like, sort of like being, you know, not giving up anything. It's not always the biggest names who draw the most page views or the most subscriptions. Like, there's a dude there at The Athletic named Chris Branch who writes their newsletter every day. I don't know if you guys subscribe to that. Like, that is like, so The Athletic, I think, has 5 million subscribers for its daily email. So just think about that. If you are the person who bylines that, that's 5 million times 5. That's potentially 25 million readers every single week reading Chris Branch. Then now do that 25 and get to 365 in terms of every day. So it's not always the case. And in Rossini's case, you bring her in, or you brought her in because she was a very well-known ESPN NFL newsbreaker. And there's certainly value in that. And the current management really likes the value in newsbreaking. But it's, I just want like people to know that it doesn't always work that way. Like, a lot of times at news organizations, you might be surprised the people behind the scenes who actually draw the most page views. And it's not always the most famous people. And in many ways, this is why, like, life is not about a meritocracy. Life is not a meritocracy. And a lot of times there are other factors as to why person X is making so much more money than person Y. And a lot of that has to do with the perception of an organization in terms of value. And that's, you know, that's the one thing that it takes all of us in media a long time to learn, is that it's not easy to get leverage. But if you have it, that's the moment you got to try to take advantage of it. And also, a lot of times, you just need the person hiring you, or the manager or management hiring you, to believe that you are the shit. And if they believe that, you can get paid a fortune. I am not equating anything to anybody else, but Burke Magnus and Jimmy Pitaro love Pat McAfee. And this puts Pat McAfee in an incredible position to make a ton of money. Same with Stephen A. Smith. Like, they just happen to think that guy's a needle mover, and you just need the people who can fund you to believe that. Anyway, speech over. John Lewis, founder and editor of Sports Media Watch. Derek Futterman, catch all his work on Sports Media Watch. Hopefully he'll be back covering the Knicks again during their championship post-championship.
We'll see.
Post-championship run. I expect the Knicks to be very good next year as well. And catch all of Armand Brody's work at Sports Media Watch as well. Those guys have had a number of really big gets when it comes to their podcast. So congrats to you, John Lewis. Like, I think you're getting, it's kudos to you. You're getting a lot of big names, where I don't know if that would have been the case, you know, 7, 8, 6 years ago. So kudos to you. Like, and you know, the one thing I've always believed in this space, like, there's not many of us who do it. So there's enough to sort of go around. You know, we're not one of 100,000 basketball podcasts. You know, there's like 12 sports media podcasts probably on earth. So there's enough to go around on that. All right. Head to the archives. If you are enjoying these kind of conversations, as I mentioned earlier, Stan Van Gundy was the guest early on this week on this podcast. He was great, talked about a lot of different stuff, including his love of the WNBA, as well as the fact that Jeff Van Gundy has no interest at the moment in returning to broadcasting. Happy to be part of the Clippers, so check that out. If you like it, please leave us a review and a note. That's how the podcast continues. Want to thank James Jackson. This was a long one for James to edit and produce. Sorry about that, James. We were very wordy today, but I appreciate your work very, very much. I want to thank everybody at Odyssey for their support, and most of all, thank you for listening. We'll see you soon on the Sports Media Podcast.